At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson. Religious freedom, what is it and why does it matter? Is it simply freedom to worship on Sunday mornings, or is it much broader than that? Joining us to talk further is Dr. Jordan Baller. He's the Director of Research at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. He's the author and editor of a number of books, particularly focusing on the Protestant Reformation, general church-state relations, and the Dutch theologian Abraham Kuyper. Jordan, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Richard. I'm happy to be here this morning.
Let's start with an understanding of what religious freedom is. And I think in the political context, we should go to the U.S. Constitution, where the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And this is where we get the idea of religious freedom as a protected civil right. And I guess it's important to understand, what did the Founding Fathers mean in doing this, putting this as our first freedom in the U.S. Constitution? So what was their purpose in doing that?
Well, it really was to protect this most sacred freedom, this most sacred right. The Founders recognized rightly that people are motivated by their beliefs about God, their beliefs about what God requires of us, what our obligations are to him and to our neighbors. And these motivations, these convictions drive us to live in different ways. And so, you know, coming out of centuries of conflict about who God is and what he requires, in the context certainly of Europe, the American founders tried to forge a better path, a path that would provide as broad a space as possible to respect those convictions, the consciences of all American citizens of whatever religious belief or creed or confession.
Good. You mentioned the religious wars in Europe back in the just prior to the America's founding. And we do know the colonies, though, prior to the founding of this nation, they conflated church and state, where they had doctrine that was part of their civil law. I mean, you couldn't hold office or vote if you weren't a Christian or a member of a certain church. They had other biblical doctrines that were part of their civil law as well. And the Founding Fathers detangled that by putting the First Amendment provision in there, saying that Congress shall make no law, essentially engaging itself in establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise of religion. Jordan, I'm reminded of a statement that Hillary Clinton made years ago, before she ever ran for the presidency, but she used the term freedom of worship. She said that we should support freedom of worship. And those who pay attention to politics and are keyed in on religious freedom and religious liberty battles seized on that statement. They said, look, it's more than just freedom to worship on Sunday mornings or worship, you know, whatever day of the week you're going to worship on. But how is, let's talk a little bit more about that. Let's press into that. What is the difference between freedom to worship and religious freedom? What is the difference there?
Yeah, well, best understood as a subset of the other. You know, you mentioned Abraham Kuyper in the introduction. That's a Dutch Reformed theologian. And so I come from that kind of Calvinist, neo-Calvinist tradition, which emphasizes serving God in all areas of life. And one way of understanding that is everything we do is worship. So you could push back and say, well, you know, freedom to worship includes everything that we do, including our work. But of course, the intent of describing that as freedom of worship is really to constrain it to the walls of a sanctuary or the things that are directly associated with institutional expressions of religion, whether that's corporate worship or ceremonial expressions of that and so on. And so that's certainly a part of what religion is. That's certainly a part of what religious freedom involves. But religious freedom is about much more than that. It really goes down all the way to the core convictions of a human being, the conscience of a person, what he or she believes God requires of him or her. So that includes everything. You know, we don't check our religion at the door when we leave the sanctuary. In fact, the right way to understand the relationship between the freedom of worship and freedom of religion is that, you know, our worship helps us prepare us and equip us to live out our religious convictions in all areas of life every day.
Yeah, that when we understand that as Christians, that's life changing. When your relationship to the Creator God and your relationship to Christ and what He's done for you, when that really sinks in. And understanding that we live before the face of God. That was the term that the Puritans used, coram Deo. We live before the face of God. All of life is living in relation to God, walking with God, doing life according to His standards. When we understand that, it's a radical change. And yet, Jordan, I think many Christians today, in this country anyway, compartmentalize the faith, where they think they're doing their Christian duty if they simply go to church every Sunday, are in prayer regularly, in the Word regularly. But as far as how it affects their Monday through Saturday schedule, I think it's fairly limited when it comes to that. Wouldn't you agree?
We can certainly do better. I mean, I know I can personally, even though I'm a theologian, you know, and maybe it's a little different for people who whose professions are involved in the institutional church. But I see it as a struggle, a personal struggle for me to find ways to have that holistic and integrated vision about what God has called me to do personally throughout every day of my life, every waking moment. And so that's definitely, I mean, it's God has called all, you know, all of us that have been called, in all aspects of our being that have been called, and every day. So it's a radical perspective, and one that has transformative power, but you have to live into that reality. And this really does, frankly, play into this this concern about religious liberty directly. So there's a sense in which it's great, really important for us to have, you know, constitutional provisions at the federal level, or statutory provisions at state levels protecting our liberties, protecting our rights. But if we don't exercise those rights, what good are they?
That's right. And that's the point I was trying to make. We do see Christians that are willing to live out their faith and go to the mat for their beliefs and their values. And those examples seem few and far between. I think of the Jack Phillipses of the world, the cake baker in Colorado that refused to bake cakes that celebrated same-sex weddings. Or right here in Kentucky, Chelsea Nelson, a photographer, who refused to do photographs of same-sex weddings. They were committed to their faith. They were committed to defending their faith, living it out in their workplace and in their calling, but also, you know, go to the mat in the way of going to the courts and fighting for their freedoms and liberties. So, Jordan, here's the direction I want to go in. So many of religious freedom cases today involve conflict between LGBT identity issues and the conscience rights, especially Christians. The most recent example of a court case that the U.S. Supreme Court just handed down recently was the 303 Creative case, where it addressed a Colorado law that infringed on the religious freedom and conscience rights of creative artists. The other side is good at couching this as Christians hiding behind bigotry. There's animus, there's anger, you're trying to marginalize the LGBT population and unnecessarily targeting them. That's what the other side's saying, but how should Christians think through this issue of when LGBT favored laws or LGBT as a civil right would infringe on Christian conscience? How should we think through this as Christians and approach?
Well, it's a great question. It's obviously one that's in front of our our eyes, and we hear about these kinds of stories every day. The case that you just pointed to, 303 Creative, the Phillips case, Sweet Cakes by Melissa. There's the photographers, all of these kinds of cases represent real struggles for people and real costs that are imposed on people. You know, unfortunately, these kinds of cases are often the result of people being targeted. Now, not because of their sexuality, but because of their religious beliefs. You know, in many of these cases, there are plenty of other establishments that would have been happy to bake the cake or provide the service of whatever it is for that particular event. Mm-hmm. But Christians who have these kinds of convictions, who have these beliefs and cannot act against their conscience, are being targeted and, you know, set up for what often it turns out to be years of litigation and massive costs. A threat to their well-being, their ability to make a living, and so on. So, you know, it's often couched in the way that you introduced it, in the sense that these are, you know, attempts by bigots to target minority communities. But the reality is, you know, the Christians with their convictions about what they can and cannot do, and often are as charitable and as generous as they possibly can be within the scope of their convictions, are the ones being targeted by these kinds of cases and these kinds of disputes. You know, in many ways, in the short term, I think the best we can hope for is for the religious liberty rights and the conscientious convictions of everybody to be respected as far as we can possibly do so, even to the point where that makes us a little uncomfortable or imposes a burden. You know, we really should do the best we can to accommodate everyone. There are obviously limits to that, but we should be as accommodating as possible. And that includes not forcing people to behave in ways they think is unethical or immoral. It includes not forcing people to say things that they don't believe. It includes freedom of speech and not coercing speech. All of these things are at play in these cases. And we certainly should be hoping for robust protections for people to live out their convictions, including in their workplace, including in their homes, including in their schools, as well as their houses of worship.
Yeah, that's good. And that's something that Commonwealth Policy Center is committed to, robust protections at the state level for conscience rights and for religious freedom provisions in general. I want to go back to something, if I could add, to those Christians who might be targeted to be coerced, to acquiesce, if you will, to laws, local laws or state law that would infringe on their conscience rights. I'd say that there's an opportunity for them to demonstrate God's grace, fruits of the Spirit, to stand firm on their conviction, not to give up on their what they really believe God is requiring of them, but to also be an ambassador for Christ. We're told in the New Testament that those who are in Christ are his ambassadors. And we have a culture that has elevated sexual identity above religious freedom and above conscience. And Christians have an opportunity to live out their faith in the marketplace. And you don't have to be a cake baker or a photographer or a graphic designer, but in the general work world, the business world, in the media realm, in the public schools, Christians have an opportunity, as these issues come before them, to engage carefully, thoughtfully, graciously, and to be Christ's ambassador. Are we seeing more of this, Jordan, where Christians who are confronted with a conflict between public policy and their conscience, are we seeing more maybe emboldened because of the Jack Phillips and the Baronelle Stutzmans and the Chelsea Nelsons? Are we seeing more step out in faith and trying to be that ambassador?
I think so. And I think it's encouraging. And you're totally correct that, you know, the world is watching how we conduct ourselves in our everyday life, in the mundane matters, all the way up to, you know, the scrutiny of being involved in a case that goes to the Supreme Court. So it's important that we stand up for our convictions and our beliefs, but that we do so in a way that reflects well on our King and our Lord. So So many of the people that you've mentioned and so many others are encountering this and being faithful in their own way and in their own contexts. And many of them are not getting recognized. You know, how many of us heard of these cases before they got up to the Supreme Court? There are years and years of fighting against negative publicity, attacks in social media and the press and so on, that these people have to endure just to see their rights respected and defended. And how many losses do you have before you can get to the Supreme Court? So, you know, on the one hand, we could say it's great, justice has been served in some of these cases. And obviously that's what the Supreme Court is there for, is to be a resort when no other institution has done justice for somebody. But on the other hand, it's a grave injustice that it has to go that far, you know, for these rights to be respected. So we can lament, even as we celebrate these victories, that so much has to so much suffering and so much anguish has to be experienced for justice to be done.
Good point. I'd like to we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about the trend of federal courts rulings on religious freedom issues. So we'll take a break and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. There's a lot of confusion about the governor's race this year. False claims, denials, and smoke screens. But at CPC, we cut through the smoke so that you can know what the candidates truly believe and what they would do if they got elected. That's why we've interviewed the candidates in person and put together voting resources to help you better understand who represents your values. So go to our website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, to find out more about the candidates and who would lead Kentucky in the best direction. And hey, make sure you get out and vote on Tuesday, November the 7th. Early voting begins on November the 2nd. So plan to vote this year, make a difference, and vote your values. Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Jordan Baller, and we're talking about religious freedom. And just before the break, we're talking about the Supreme Court, and really I want to go into the federal courts and the trends in ruling on religious freedom. And Jordan, if I'm not mistaken, federal courts have, for the last number of years, have ruled in favor of conscience rights of Christians and religious freedom provisions as well, where they have, especially when it comes to SOGI laws, those are sexual orientation and gender identity laws that put sexual orientation as a civil right into the, whether local or state level, those laws have been challenged and in some cases provisions have been struck down. We saw that in Louisville with the Chelsea Nelson case not too long ago. Is it fair to say, though, that the federal courts have been favorable towards religious freedom and conscience rights in this country?
In certain areas, I think that's true. You know, it depends which courts you're talking about, of course, and which cases. Certainly at the Supreme Court level, you know, the last two terms have seen really important cases, from the Coach Kennedy case to the Groff case to 303 Creative, which we've already discussed. So certainly by the time you get up to the Supreme Court, you're seeing, I think, much more responsible decisions being made. Decisions that are grounded in looking at what the history of American jurisprudence is, looking at precedent in a responsible way, and making decisions that are not aimed at just being popular, but aimed at getting at the justice, to doing justice to the matter. So, as with anything, you know, there's important concerns over who gets appointed, which administrations are in control, and so on. And the signs are hopeful, at least in the bigger cases that have received a lot of attention, there's a bit of a shift in terms of trying to respect everybody's conscience rights.
You helped with the publication, the Religious Liberty in the States. And last year, Kentucky ranked 24th. This year, we are ranked 39th. Areas and categories that you measured were contraception, general conscience in healthcare, abortion, sterilization, forced immunization, absentee voting, officiating of marriages and weddings, and communion wine. Now, Kentucky performed pretty low in these areas. So those are important areas of religious freedom, and yet I think generally as citizens, we don't think of those as religious freedom categories, do we? So how did you come to, I guess we'll start with this, how did you come to include these areas in your study on religious liberty in the states?
So the methodology really is to see what's out there in the state law, whether it's state constitutions or statutes that are identified by states as religiously relevant, because the language of a religious exemption or safeguard is in the text itself, and then compare, you know, what's done in one state to what's been done in the other states. So in that sense, it's really a ground up or bottom up kind of approach. We could have said, well, here's what an ideal, you know, legal situation for state level protections of religious exercise would be, and then see if any states match it. But this approach, I think, allows us, has a number of advantages. One is we're not imposing some kind of ideal standard on the states. We're letting the states speak for themselves, or let their actions speak. And then using that as a way to compare states. So, you know, by the time you get to an index, you've run the numbers, you have a percentage score, but that 100% score is not some arbitrary standard. It's a score that's set by the frontier of what other states are already doing. So for every safeguard, for example, that Kentucky doesn't have, there's at least one and often many more states who do have a safeguard. And so it provides a kind of a practical tool for legislators and policymakers and citizens to say, hey, look, you know, our neighbor states or a state halfway across the country is doing this to protect religious liberty. We never thought of it, frankly. You know, we didn't know that these kinds of safeguards were possible or that they were important. And so there's, in many ways, we're just trying to provide information about what other states are doing. And in so doing, hopefully provide a bit of an incentive or a prod for states to look more at what they're doing and what, and frankly, what they could be doing and should be doing to protect free exercise.
To that point, Jordan, one reason why Kentucky may not have taken action like other states have in these particular areas is because I've heard legislators tell me, look, Richard, until it happens here, we're not going to address it. Now, it's instructive of what other states are doing, but yeah. Legislators want to know, is it happening here? Is there a threat to religious freedom in one of these categories in Kentucky? And when that happens, then they will often take action. Case in point is Senate Bill 150, and this has gotten national attention. This is a comprehensive bill dealing with LGBT curriculum in public schools, age-appropriate curriculum, gender-preferred pronouns in the classroom, bathroom policy. It also dealt with gender transition of minors. But this issue did not have movement until last year under Kentucky Department of Education guidance. They encouraged teachers. They said the best practice of teachers is to use the preferred gender pronouns of students and to not tell parents if that could lead to conflict in the home. Now, that policy that was actually embraced by one of the local school districts not far from here, that resulted in a Christian principal losing his job. He was put on administrative leave because he said, look, I can't, first of all, I'm not going to participate in a student's gender dysphoria. And secondly, I'm not going to keep that hidden from parents. Now, that resulted in him losing his job eventually. He left the field, but endured a lot of hardship. When that came to light and when legislators learned of that, there was a response, and it was a pretty swift response to say, no, that's not going to be the policy in our public schools. We need to protect the conscience rights of teachers. Teachers shouldn't be forced to participate in the, a fiction that students are insisting upon. So in that case, we did see a good result when it came to protecting the conscience rights of teachers. This is an issue, the gender-preferred pronouns in the classrooms. That was not an area, Jordan, that you covered in your report. Is that something that you'll be looking at in the future? Is that something that you might include? Because that's a religious freedom issue, isn't it?
Yeah. So our goal is to make this measure as comprehensive as possible. So from year one to year two, we moved from 29 identified safeguards that you know, our researchers combed through the laws to find. And according to our methodology, in terms of what we could discover across all 50 states and whether there were comparable sorts of provisions that were able to be found and so on, we increased that number to 34 this year. So that is why, for example, Kentucky moved down. It's not because the laws in Kentucky changed, it's because we were able to broaden the scope of what we're looking at. And that certainly is the goal going forward, is to continue to increase the scope of what this measure covers, so it's as robust as possible. So it's just giving as comprehensive a picture as is possible, given the practical limitations that we have to have an index that literally can take the text of a law and then assign a number value to it, a zero or one, whether that safeguard is present or not, and identify that across all 50 states. So we're actively looking at areas where we can expand the scope of the index to include things like education, even more than we already have.
So perhaps Kentucky will rise in your rankings next year if you include that question in your survey, right?
Potentially, but I can say for sure Kentucky would rise if laws were passed, you know, of the things that we're measuring. And, you know, to the point about whether something's already happening or not, I mean, I think the reality of it is we live in such a integrated society that if it's happening in one place, it can definitely happen in another. And so I just think of it as instructive. You know, it may be that through the policymaking process that Kentuckians decide, well, you know, Mississippi may have this provision and maybe we don't have to, but it's better to, I think, to at least consider the possibility that we might want to have a safeguard like another state does. And that's what this index is really designed to do, is to be a tool for education and understanding what other states are doing and wherever appropriate, use those as models.
Jordan, I'd like to talk with you off air about how Kentucky can strengthen its religious freedom laws and conscience rights protections. One question I think that's important to get in here, and I really can't address it, but I do want to raise it. This is the limits of religious freedom. It's not an absolute right, is it?
Time, the best I can do is to quote the political theorist William Galston, who said, "No free exercise for Aztecs," right? There are limits.
Yeah.
Yeah. To what we can do. And an even shorter answer, I would say, is the moral order, the natural law. You don't ever lose right to violate the moral order.
No, that's good. And maybe we need to do another program just on the limits of religious freedom and proper exercise of religious freedom, especially for Christians. But Jordan, this conversation has been helpful. I've enjoyed it. We'll just have to have you on again.